in a couple months, there will be a report on how the fossil fuel industry has infiltrated our classrooms. This is not new because the climate crisis is so extreme now. It is harmful to students to be offering that kind of education.
Everything depends on your admin. And the reason that is because there is no updated standards for special education. So that hasn't been done since 2003 with an amendment in 2004. I was part of the fight to end seclusion rooms and restraints. It's horrific. It's traumatizing. We need to remove that out of schools. No, there's no space for it. Well, they put back in and reinstated, and Edmonton has some of the highest uses of seclusion rooms in Alberta.
It recommends that all schools set up green governance committees, including students, teachers, parents. And parents, we don't have to wait for the UCP. In fact, I'm tired of waiting for the UCP.
I would really like to see our province and our educators and everybody on that step of what's next, what's creative, let's try some things, let's get crazy, versus what the UCP is doing, which is like, let's go 20 years back, because that never worked anyways.
I would just love to see provincial leadership just like valuing kids as kids, not just see them as like future adults. So I'm in rural Alberta. Putting myself out there as a tree hugger can be a little bit scary sometimes, but like, I have never had anything like negative come towards me from that.
It was not a problem with forest management in Jasper National Park. The Jasper National Park spent 30 years reducing fuel around that town. And it wasn't a problem of mountain pine beetles. The forestry industry loves us to freak out over mountain pine beetles because it allows them to throw away the rule books such as they are and log even harder. Mountain pine beetle spread has been is a product of climate change. As our winters get milder and our summers get droughtier and the trees get more stressed, mountain pine beetles will do well. We've got to stop living as if there's no consequences to doing whatever we want. Since my primary focus for the last few years has been on water security.
The problem with the status quo is the quo has long passed its status. We've got to stop ignoring the evidence and use that evidence to help us understand where we need to go, particularly with the eastern slopes. And as Kevin said, the primary importance of the eastern slopes to Albertans and a reminder to us that we're a headwaters province, and that we're also responsible for two other provinces downstream from us.
In terms of land preservation and preventing these mining operations, be it gravel, be it coal, be it oil and gas, or general expansion of communities or what have you, we should also have an equal or greater focus on habitat preservation and restoration to ensure that some of the most unique and vital habitats are maintained and preserved.
We came together around a piece of this landscape that we value and care for, and we fought for its future. Well, that's a people becoming the best of what they can be. That's Albertans no longer just calling ourselves Albertans, but being Albertans. We need to take responsibility collectively to know our neighbors and to work with them to give us a better future.
We have treated the eastern slopes like a warehouse to be ransacked instead of a place of investment. And we've created a land use footprint that contributes to flooding and drought and the loss of ecological indicators like native trout. And unfortunately, because we don't often recognize these things, we also have created a phenomena of shifting benchmarks where many think that nothing has changed. We've got to invest in things that aren't necessarily the things of the past, but the things of the future. Every little bit doesn't count unless you do every little bit.
We still have a lot of intact and potential to keep the web of life held together. We just need a shift in our priorities from endless growth and more money, more jobs, to what does a regenerative economy look like? How do we trade our values for wealth that's financial versus wealth that is the beauty of the natural world and all of the abundance it provides?
The province does have a nomination process for sites to be put on timelines. I think there is an opportunity for certain regions to get organized the ones that are of high priority, that is the Eastern Slopes, local, you know, in the community hall. What is the landscape that we want to preserve, and what is the landscape that we want to return back to its normal state? Our thoughts are trying to help empower those communities to help having the difficult conversations with their neighbors and with their representatives to try and make sure that we start making decisions on the landscape. We are the headwaters for not just Saskatchewan and Manitoba, but even down to the Mississippi. A really big portion of North America's water that we're responsible for.
Focus on one area, one task, and provide proof of concept in that so people can see the results and they can go, that does work. Maybe we should expand it, because that's going to be the real test. That's going to be the real source of inspiration so that more people are going to get on board with it and see it as a good idea.
Every single land use decision that we make is a water management decision. Because we separate land management from water management, we make a whole bunch of really goofy land management decisions that we pay for with water management consequences. And they lead us to bad water management decisions like building dams on the Red Deer River and expanding irrigation in an arid province during an era of climate change.
Land held in common gives all of us Albertans something to collectively fight for. And as Kevin talked about how the coal debate came together from all sectors, all portions, all corners of Alberta, there's strength and conviction in the crowd over and above individual political and corporate desires. We're not necessarily alone. There is some collective will out there. The challenge is harnessing it.
If you're thinking about Chinese medicine at all, we need to think of it as its own unique, complete system of medicine. So we use Chinese medicine to treat, to prevent, and also to diagnose disease, but from a Chinese medicine perspective. So some things will be very similar to how we see things in Western medicine, but many things are quite different. And that just comes with that it's been around for 2,000 years plus. And so, you know, back then we didn't have technology to help us diagnose things, right? We had observation as our main tool. And, you know, when you have a giant population, you can really hone in on what the trends are pretty quickly. So there's definitely been some benefit to how this originated and how it's come to be as we know it today. Truthfully, it's only been in the West since the 1970s. Richard Nixon actually went over to China to reestablish some connections and get some trade happening. And oddly enough, one of his journalists ended up having an appendix attack, had to go into the hospital, had his appendix removed. But while he was there getting his treatment, he also received acupuncture for pain relief and just overall general healing. And he was just impressed by it. So he came back and he wrote an article for New York Times, key component of facial diagnosis specifically for Chinese medicine, recognizes those elements. So, you know, we're going to look at your jaw and we're going to find out what's the state of your jing, what's the state of your essence or your constitution, like how much fortitude were you born with kind of thing. And I think I was mentioning, like, you can build that. There are people that are put into like politics, or they have to be the face of something, or they have to, you know, deliver news to mass audiences or whatnot. And they have to like be the courageous, I'm strong, like, yeah, I got your back kind of feeling. And some people's face shapes will actually change over time based on what's required of them as they go through life. And Lillian Bridges was the lady who is basically the, I guess you could say her, the godmother of facial diagnosis. She comes from a long line of people who did this. Sadly, she's passed away now, but she was always really good at quickly pointing out key features in people and saying, here's when this arrived. If you look back to 1982, you'll see whoever's image change, and it'll be because something significant happened. So she cites the one lady who, you know, she saw in her office, and the next time she saw her, she had a really dimpled up chin, and the dimpled up chin shows a state of fear. Like there was fear and shock, and it's hit in the kidney area, which is your water element. And so she asked her, like, what happened? And she basically had a massive car accident, right? So a major trauma. We also can note that Donald Trump has a very dimpled chin.
My philosophy is on how taking and replacing us with someone who's clearly not who we are is a form of violence. The idea was that when you try and misrepresent yourself as a part of our communities it causes a rift and a and it becomes a it creates a ricochet effect, and that ricochet effect is a form of violence.
The problem is when they come into our lands, into these lands that have been gifted to us to care for by a source of life, and they come here and everything is a free for all. Not only are the lands appropriated, not only are our lifeways appropriated, but our very identities are appropriated. And the agenda of settler colonialism is erase and replace. Erase Indigenous lifeways and replace them. And the law is very narrow in terms of how it defines violence. But there's a spiritual violence, there's emotional violence, there's a mental violence, psychological violence. When we are misrepresented in that way, that violence is taking place. And what are the ramifications of that violence? The perpetuation of stereotypes. Now, when and the this constant placing of Indigenous people in the past, at the heart of this is materialism and the value that is placed not on relationships, but on material wealth. Who is most at risk of being duped by pretendians is actually members of settler society, white settler society.
The term capitalism, capitalist was a person who collected heads. And this is profoundly appropriate for this particular conversation because that's what they're doing. They're taking our place. They're taking our head. And this is where violence comes in. This is the core essence of it. The materialism is born out of this long romantic relationship with capitalism and capitalizing on another person's misfortune. You're seeing a lot of natives being upset because we are literally watching ourselves being replaced by non-native people, people who do not have our learned experience, people who do not have our family history. They're claiming to create communities. And they're claiming that they belong to specific landmarks and places. And they're negotiating for deals for mining and resource extraction. And it's on our territory.
So rather than adopt, I think we need to think about how are we participating ethically in with Indigenous lifeways, with Indigenous ways. If I know who I am, if I know where I come from, if I know my stories, and I'm ethical with myself, I will be ethical with other people. So if I don't know where I come from and I'm, you know, confused and I don't have the appropriate capacity or there's no community capacity, never mind community capacity, national capacity for youth to figure out who am I? You know, it's that question is huge. I mean, it's like, who am I? Where do I come from? And why does it matter? Reducing Indigenous culture that it's so, you know, being Indigenous is, it's so easy to figure out, you know, all you got to do is take a course. There is no choice for us in who we are as Blackfoot. This is who we are. Like there is no choice. Choice, the way it's thought of in Eurocentric culture, that is a imagining or that's been made up, this idea that you can choose your identity. That's privilege. Like, that's privilege right there. And this is also about racism as well. And it's violence. And this idea that you can take aspects of Indigenous culture and Indigenous ways of being as if they're garments to be donned and garments to be put on, you know, and then represent yourself that way.
Probably the reason why the analogy of the two-row wampum is the way it is that you have your road to go down and we'll have our road to go down. We're rowing two boats at the same time and we're going along course together. We've been at this philosophically for 400 years now. We're not coming up with answers, but we're going to need to come up with answers fast.
We are continuing to even move even further backwards because now more than ever, we've had more kids in the child welfare that are Indigenous more than ever. We have more Indigenous people that continue to die every day. Where's the conversations about land? Are we talking about that? Are we returning to that? And I heard this from a brilliant First Nations scholar from Australia who says it's not necessarily about land back. It's like everybody return to land. We need a return back to land.
My birth name was actually Gary Sparvier.
Okay.
But I am from the Wet'suwet'en family. That's the traditional name.
Gotcha.
My name, how I came about to get the name Carrie Lynn, I've had that since I was 5.5 years old. I'm actually 60 Scoobin residential school survivor. Years after I was taken away at 1 month, I was in 5 different foster homes. I went to 6 years residential school starting at 5.5 years old. And it was in residential school that I found out that I was different inside. That I had both boy and girl in me, born or assigned male at birth. I went to residential school, and I'm left-handed, and I went to a Catholic residential school. And then the sister superior kind of took me as a pet project to convert me to being right-handed. And they were very unsuccessful with me. And part of the punishment for continuing to use my left hand is they did what some call petticoating. They put me in the girls' uniform, made me sit on the girls' side of the classroom because we were segregated, boys and girls. Mm-hmm. And eventually I moved into the girls' dorm and lived as a girl for 5.5 years. And I realized very quickly after that happened that it was not wrong. Yeah. First of all, you mentioned the word binary thinking. And that actually stems from a way to control the masses, starting with, you know, the Dark Ages and the Renaissance. It was a way the churches and the rich used to subjugate and keep the poor, right? And weaponize religion,
right?
Weaponize religion. And in that is binary thinking, you know, only male and female marry for procreation to get more followers of the church is the ultimate goal, right? And the rich.
Economy, yeah.
Right, to keep the rich.